So let me ask how you feel about the future of the world. There's growing evidence of a kind of generation gap, at least in the UK and the US, where people who are sort of 30 and above tend to be broadly optimistic, happy people. You must have thought that. But true of me, I think, deep in my being, I just think things will probably be all right, probably get better. But a survey of UK teenagers last year found that 34% thought their life would be no better when they got to the age of 30, and 55% thought it would be worse. In fact, 9% felt entirely hopeless about their future. And I guess, whether you're above 30 or below 30, that the news this weekend will not have helped. If you care most about the environment, you can look at consensus internationally going backwards on climate action. If you care most about security, well, I heard a senior Ukrainian tell the BBC this afternoon that the peace deal on the table was America withdrawing from NATO and the defence of Europe. Or if you care most about finances, the cost of living, well, you can read any number of articles about the budget this weekend. Nearly all of them miserable. So with optimistic older people and pessimistic younger people, what do we say? Well, younger people, you are probably right in that default optimism is probably foolish and naive. If I'd grown up in one of those parts of the world that have experienced war or famine through all of the years I've been alive, would I still think of things as getting better? Even here in the UK, the generation older than me grew up certain there would be a nuclear war. Before that, it was World War II. Before that, it was the Great Depression. Before that, it was World War I. And yet, hopelessness is so obviously not the solution, isn't it? There's the obvious danger it just becomes self-fulfilling. Because we give up. All of the great global change movements have come from people who believed they could make a difference, willing to risk, willing to persevere. And then there's the obvious danger of exaggeration, isn't there? If misery is what makes you click, then your algorithm will give you more misery and more misery. And actually, people have always worried. And Jesus here says they always will, because there will always be wars, rumors of wars, and earthquakes and famines. We're here for Jesus and his teaching, his indestructible words. It's the end of our series in the final week before they killed him. Chapter 13, it is the longest single speech in Mark's gospel, longest thing Jesus has to say. And he has something radically different to say, different to the Western teenager and their hopelessness, different to the middle-aged person or the boomer confidence in their increasing wealth and prosperity. This is a chapter in which Jesus definitively answers questions about the future. And we covered a lot of detail last week, and there is a Q&A question time this evening if you want to know more, but let me just give you the headline. The headline is this: Jesus was right about everything. So in 2 minutes, what did Jesus say last week? He was asked about the big event, the end of the world, and he was asked about the sign that would mean it was about to happen. And we said last week he gave them more than they bargained for. He gave them a sign, all right, the sign that led to a big event that was itself a sign of the really big event, the end of the world. So he predicts an abomination of desolation, a desecration of the temple. And he says, immediately after that, the temple itself will be destroyed and Jerusalem will be filled with unequaled distress. And he said, that will be the final sign to say everything is ready for the end of the world. And we said, Jesus, he is right about everything, and that we know that now in ways that they couldn't have known when he spoke or when Mark wrote. So this was the final slide last week. There are some dates. Jesus spoke in 33 AD. He announced the demolition of the temple and the eviction of his people from Jerusalem. Both of them ludicrously unlikely events at the time. And then Mark wrote, is the red arrow, maybe in 60 AD, something like that, when those things would still have looked deeply unlikely. And Jesus said it would happen within one generation of when he was speaking. And it did. He was right about the time frame. He was right about the blasphemous desecration of the temple. He was right to tell them to flee from the mountains when that happened, because maybe 2 years later, AD 70, he was right about the destruction of the temple and the end of the security of the Jewish people in the promised land. In Bible history, this is the seismic event. Deeply unlikely in 33 AD, and then it all came true. Jesus, he was right about all of that. So what do you think when he speaks about the main event of it all, about the end of the world? Look down at verse 28. Verse 28, where Jesus, he asks us to learn a very simple lesson from a fig tree. I need to say it's a different lesson, and in fact a different fig tree from the one we met in chapter 11 in September. He says, learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that it is near, right at the door. So understanding the end of the world is not about chasing after a huge list of signs. Remember I said this is an easy chapter. Not a hard chapter. It isn't complex and difficult and hidden. It isn't, verse 21, worrying that the Messiah might be over there or over here. It isn't chasing after him so that you don't miss him. Verse 28, it is as obvious as predicting summer from the return of leaves on your fig tree. One big unmistakable sign, one big certain event. So verse 29, when you see these things happening, meaning the 68 to 70 AD stuff, the abomination, and then the seismic event, the destruction of Jerusalem. When you see that, you know that Jesus is near, right at the door. And verse 30, these things happened within one generation, AD 68 to 70, and Jesus, he was right about everything. And from the point of view of, you know, mountains and oceans and the heavens, verse 31, Jesus' words are more reliable, more solid than their own existence. If Jesus says the end of the world is the next big event, then the whole created world just says, well, we're waiting for our orders from the one who created us using only his words. His words are reliable. So let me show you the shape of the rest of our time tonight. We're going to say the end of the world will be. We'll look at what Jesus tells us and also what he does not tell us about the end of the world. And then with slightly less time, we'll look at what we're supposed to do about it. So the end of the world will be. And just before I give you any of the sort of data, just notice Jesus simply thinks there will be an end. And notice that challenges both the pessimism of the younger generation and the optimism of the older generation. Because both of those groups, we think that the outcome is up to us, don't we? We'll make the world better, or we're going to make the world worse, whichever way. That's not the Bible picture at all. In fact, the Bible thinks it would be deeply, deeply alarming and deeply difficult to try and live in a world where we were ultimately in charge. We have much better news for a hopeless generation. Just think, even just the Old Testament quotes we've had this autumn. We've had Psalm 2 and Psalm 110 and Psalm 118, and they're all about a world in which Jesus is in charge, where God the Father has made an irreversible decision. Jesus on his throne. Chapter 12, verse 36 on the same page. Jesus says, this is where I went after my death and my resurrection. I'm on the throne now, and I'm only waiting for my enemies to be placed under my feet. So the world isn't spiraling. It isn't cyclical. It isn't uncertain. It isn't self-determining. It has an end. It is traveling to a certain end at the hands of the Creator and the King. And that makes it a totally different world to live in. A world with a king, a creator, a world with an end. And given that, isn't there so much that you want to know? Not least, above all, don't you want to know the date? Don't you want to know when? More on that in a second, because Jesus has decided and given us here everything that we need to know. So first of all, the end of the world will be obvious. Look at verse 24. In those days following that distress, and then Jesus quotes from the Isaiah reading that Jess read, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light. And if you thought that might only be a sort of temporary eclipse or in only one part of the world, the stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. It will be obvious. At its simplest, this is still part of calm down from last week. Do you remember calm down from our diagram? One very short period of time where you need to take urgent action. The rest of all of history, calm down. Don't be led astray, verse 22, by false messiahs and false prophets. In the days after the destruction of Jerusalem, they'll try and deceive you, and you need to be on your guard when they pretend that they've found the Messiah. Or they pretend that they are the Messiah. Because when the real thing happens, it will be absolutely obvious. Won't matter what time zone you're in. Won't matter whether you're looking up at the sky or not. Nobody will be able to miss the day when Jesus returns. The entire creation will be dissolved and recreated. You will notice. Okay. Second, it will be final. Jesus here, he emphasizes his power and he emphasizes the outcome for his people. Look at verse 26. At that time, people will see the Son of Man, his normal chosen name for himself, coming in clouds with great power and glory. And he will send his angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heavens. This will be final. And you heard, I think, in Jess's first reading, some of the how final it will be for God's enemies, the judgment that God will bring. But last week at the preacher's meeting, two people also helped me see the connection to all of the material we've had about the temple in chapter 11, chapter 12. Jesus' first coming and Jesus' second coming, they are parallel. Jesus in chapter 11, he arrived as king to inspect his temple and his people. And it was final. He saw through all of the activity that impressed everybody, but not him. That was never what God had asked for. He saw through the hypocrisy. He was decisive and he was fair and he was powerful. They were all amazed at how he answered all the questions. And that is the background parallel when Jesus now says he will return on that day. Jesus is on his throne and he is now the cornerstone. This is 12 verse 10, even though he was rejected. And when he returns, he will be as sure of foot, as good, as clear-sighted as he was that day. He will return to judge everything that is cruel and evil and wrong with this world. Even if it rests in my heart and my actions. But, third one, don't miss that it will be wonderful on that day. Jesus, in this chapter, he's not speaking anymore to his enemies. It's just to his disciples. It's to those who he has said are going to face decades of persecution and betrayal and hardship just to get to the sign before the sign of the end of the world. For them, the power and the glory of the king on his throne, he's saying it is for you. He comes back to gather his chosen people, to gather them to himself. These are the ones he wants to see, the people he wants to be with forever. That's what the end of the world means, as Jesus explains it. And if you have any doubts whether that day will be wonderful, you have everything that you need in Mark's gospel, don't you? There's the character of the person that we meet through chapters 1 to 10. There's the astonishing man who amazed them with his answers in the chapters we've had this autumn. There's the love of the Son of God who, in the next two chapters, walks deliberately to die on a cross for his enemies because he loves us. And the end of the world, it means him. Forget all of the details and the everything else. It means him. If you are a believer in Jesus, it means seeing him. It means being with him. He judges the temple so that he can extend the relationship to anyone who believes in him. And then he will return to gather all those people to himself. So just ask, if you ever catch yourself hoping that Jesus won't come back yet, do you ever think that? Just not yet. Sometimes that might be about a job or an achievement or about your wedding or about an experience. If there's anything you haven't done yet that makes us think we would rather delay meeting Jesus, then we haven't really understood how wonderful he is and how small and how thin everything else in this world is compared to him. So the end of the world will be obvious, final, and wonderful. But there are two left where I need to change the verb to is, because they're about how things are now. The end of the world is of unknown date, verse 32. About that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Isn't that a surprise? Given that the only question they really asked was when, and we said the only thing we really want to know is when, in the longest speech in Mark's Gospel, when Jesus tells us everything we need to know about the end of the world, not only does he not bother to tell us when, he takes the time to make sure we know that we will never know until the day, the obvious and final and wonderful, is happening all around us. And verse 32 gets some people very excited. People like my Muslim barber get very excited about verse 32 as if it proves that Jesus wasn't God. Do you see why? One of the definitions of God is that he knows everything. But Jesus here says that he doesn't know the date of the end of the world. And that is a tricky conversation to have when someone's got a razor at your neck. You know, do you think Jesus is all-knowing? Nod or shake. None of those work very well. But it is not something that should trouble us if we know the first thing about Christmas, actually. We're plugging Christmas tonight. The whole claim of Christmas is that God limited himself and took on flesh and appeared as a man, as a baby. And Jesus, who is both God and man, that's the claim, he had all kinds of limitations as a man, but not as God. See, the most obvious is not the one we've got here. If you think about it, the definition of God is that he is present everywhere, all the time. But the moment you have one individual baby, it is obvious that Jesus as a man is not present everywhere, all of the time. And this is just the same. Jesus as God clearly has access to all of the knowledge of God. And you can see that in Mark's Gospel and the other Gospels. There are times when he knows what people are thinking. There's a time when he can see somebody under a tree in a town miles away. There's a time when he knows where a coin will be inside a fish. There are times when he predicts the future, decades ahead, with total accuracy and gets it entirely right about everything. But Jesus as a man, he does limit his knowledge, perhaps so that the sort of limited hardware of a human brain doesn't explode with all that knowledge. But this one fact in particular, the date of the end of the world, that is one of the facts Jesus decided to limit, to keep back from himself as a man. He and the Father decided that he wouldn't know. And Jesus as a man speaks here about the end of the world, knowing any number of miraculous facts about it, but very, very happy not to know the date. Can you think of any more persuasive way to help you and me be happy with the fact that we don't know and will never know? And we'd love to know. You can tell that from the fact there are armies of YouTube people and shelves of Christian books all about trying to predict the end or help you know when. But if Jesus says no one knows, and if Jesus himself is happy not to know, don't you think that we should be okay with that? And again, you can ask me more in the Q&A, and I want to be remain open to the fact there's lots I don't understand in Bible prophecy about our world. But isn't it clear here that any Christian movement that thinks they can tell you the date has lost connection with the Son, who deliberately made sure he didn't know himself? And it's clear we cannot possibly need to know the date, otherwise he would have told us. And my concern here is that as Christians, we get so easily distracted, hours of time and energy and worry on trying to guess a date that he tells us he doesn't want us to know. Last week, I think I said something really wrong and unfair. I said that all of that movement of the predictions and the guessing, it's like the epidural of the end of the world baby. Thinking about that more, I just think that's wrong, because epidurals are wonderful, aren't they? Amazing gift of modern medicine. A doctor's going to have to tell me, come and tell me what this really is like in pregnancy terms. Prophecies about the 23rd of September 2025, they're much worse than an epidural. They're really distracting, drag us away from what we're supposed to be doing. Okay, then, last one under point one. The end of the world is right at the door. It's the key thing Jesus wants us to know. Takes us back to where we began. If you see the sign, the leaves on the tree, the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, then what you know is that Jesus is near, right at the door. Chapter 13 contains all of the signs that Jesus thinks that there are. Takes us right up to the point in AD 70 and plus one day when Jesus' key is in the lock and his hand is on the latch. He's right at the door. Means that from God's point of view, he could have come back in AD 71 or AD 800 or AD 1745 or yesterday would have been a good day for him to come back, or tonight. Again, let's pause. No? Tonight or tomorrow or next week or 2050 or 3050. Again, you can ask in the Q&A. There is much that I want to remain open to. But from here, I think that any Christian movement that teaches Jesus could not come back yet hasn't taken on fully the simplicity of what he's saying here. The sign, we've seen it. The event is right at the door. There may well be many, many things still to happen in God's plan, known to him. May well be that God is waiting for those things for the perfect time for his Son to return. May even be that when we've been gathered to him and we look back with him and we look back at all those things, there'll be bits of the Old Testament or bits of the book of Revelation that suddenly snap into focus for us. Oh, I see, you prefigured that there. But the attitude he wants us all to have from AD 70 onwards is the one in verse 34. It's the attitude of the servant with the master who could come back at any time. So any Christian movement that, I don't know, says Russia has to invade Israel first, or says Bible translation has to reach a certain level of penetration of our world, or whatever else, any version of he could not come back tonight, I think doesn't fit the place that Jesus wants to leave us all in this chapter. And my concern is that if I carve out an amount of time before he comes back, an amount of time when he can't yet come back, then I've carved out an amount of time when I can serve myself, or I can sleep, in the language of the final illustration here. Because really it is those last two headings that Jesus drives to application on. There is this event that is right around the corner, could be any moment, but crucially, you and I, we have no idea when. Could be any moment, but we don't know when. So, application, we need to be ready all of the time. That's the very simple application of this chapter. And just driving that out is keep watch and be at work. Those are the two ways he explains it. Look down at verse 33. So the application of the chapter is be on guard, be alert, be ready all the time, because you do not know when that time will come. So what is it like being a Christian? What's the experience of the Christian life? Well, it's like a household of servants when the owner has gone away and is coming back, and they don't know when, but they know he's definitely coming back. So they have to be ready all the time. And just notice, we can drive this out more in application in the questions, but notice the dignity. He says he puts his servants in charge. Jesus hasn't abandoned us in this difficult world full of suffering and betrayal and wars and disaster. He has put us in charge until we see him and with work to do. And notice how open the time expectation is. It might be a short time, or verse 35, it might be a long time. It might be the master comes back that evening, barely any time at all. Or it might be midnight, or when the cock crows, or even at dawn, all the way into the next day. Mark's gospel is really Peter's gospel. Mark was something like a ghostwriter, a secretary for Peter. And in Peter's letters, he quotes from a psalm about how 1,000 years feels like a single day to God. The illustration and that point from the letter makes the same point. God, Jesus has not been away for a very long time at all. And we are still supposed to be living like these servants, so that if he comes suddenly, do not let him find you sleeping. And that's not that Jesus hates sleep. It's not that you have to stay up. I need to stay up a bit late tonight to catch up on I'm a Celebrity. I've fallen behind over the weekend. But this is more about choosing to live as someone who is expecting Jesus back at any moment. Might be now, might be now, might be now, might be now. And here he says that is about watching. As in constantly looking, but with your heart, not with your eyes. And that is also about warning. Do you see the point of the servant in verse 34, the one placed on the door to keep watch for the others? I think you've got to say this is an area in which the church in the 20th century and early 21st century has very largely failed. A church that is broadly embarrassed by this teaching of Jesus that he will return. When actually, none of the rest of Jesus' life and work and ministry makes sense without his return. The king on the throne, God's throne, who is not coming back, it is the answer to injustice and to suffering. Jesus is entirely certain about it here, and this is the chapter in which he is right about everything. And yet, most of the time, we hide this from people. Keep watch so that you can warn others, seems to be the sense. Watch and warn. And then also it's about working. Working, it says, verse 34, at your assigned task. And I think that's still in the illustration, still in the metaphor. It doesn't mean that each of us have, you know, one thing, one piece of Christian duty we've got to do all our lives or one job. It's the metaphor of the busy, diligent, good servant. So you go to the rest of the gospel and the rest of chapters 11 to 13 to fill out what that means. Come with me and fish for men, Jesus says at the beginning of the gospel. Bring others to trust in this returning king. Or chapter 11, 12, 13, bear fruit. Bear fruit for him. Don't bear leaves that make you look good, but bear actual fruit. Fruit that's things like love for God, love for your neighbor, as we live in a world that we know has an end, and not an end that depends on us, not a future that we're pessimistic about or optimistic about based on our own ability and effort, but one that he has determined and left us to work for, working for the one who came for sinners to die for them. Because it will be wonderful on the day when we and they meet him as one of those he sends the angels to go and fetch. What a day that will be. Let me pray. Our Heavenly Father, thank you for the Lord Jesus. Thank you that he tells us what we need to know, if not everything we want to know. Please, our Father, would we be those who are awake? Would we live in this world as if we believed in the words of Jesus, that one day, a day just like this one, there will be a day when everyone will see him, every knee will bow, a day when it will matter more than any other of the distractions and concerns and burdens of our life, It will matter whether we have knelt to him and trusted him on the day we see him face to face. So we ask our Father, enable us to be awake and working and ready for the day we see Jesus. Amen.